Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderpook. Has a nearly century-old law intended to protect American jobs and shore up U.S. trade been hindering relief efforts in Puerto Rico? It was waived by presidential order earlier today. The president of the Hawaii Shippers Council offers his perspective. And NASA astronaut Colonel Mike Fink talks about daily life on the International Space Station. American puppeteer Tom Lee collaborates with a Japanese master of a centuries-old tradition to create a new theatrical fusion with the show Shank's Mare. It's September 28th, day two of our fall pledge drive. Those conversations and a few more right after this news. Earlier today, President Trump announced a 10-day waiver of a 1920 federal law that has been blamed for hindering relief efforts in the Caribbean. Puerto Rico remains in desperate need in the wake of Hurricane Maria. The Merchant Marine Act of 1920, the so-called Jones Act, prohibits ships from hauling cargo between U.S. ports unless those vessels are American-made and manned by a crew made up of 75% U.S. citizens. The crisis in Puerto Rico has led to a new round of calls for the repeal of the Jones Act. The issues here are very familiar to Hawaii Shippers Council President Mike Hansen. He's on hand to help us sort them out. Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here, Chris.
Let's outline what the Jones Act does in terms of what it was intended to do.
The Jones Act is one of a series of what are known as cabotage laws that have been passed in the United States, and they basically restrict the use of commercial vessels in domestic U.S. commerce to those vessels that are built in the United States, registered under the U.S. flag, crewed essentially by U.S. citizens, owned by U.S. citizens, and managed by U.S. citizens.
Protectionist measures.
Absolutely, yeah. Which means that, for example, you can't import a foreign-built vessel, reflag it U.S., and then operate it with a U.S. crew in the United States on a commercial basis. We can do that with airplanes. We can do that with taxis. We can do that with trains. We can do that with mass transit vehicles.
It's only boats, huh?
It's only vessels, yeah.
Vessels. Ships, boats, right? What would you like to see done about it?
Well, Hawaii Shippers Council has been advocating for some time now that the so-called non-contiguous trades of the United States, that's Alaska, Guam, Hawaii, and Puerto Rico, be exempted from the U.S. build requirement of the Jones Act or the cabotage laws writ large. And the reason for that is that U.S. shipbuilding costs are about five times what they are in Japan and South Korea, where wage levels are fairly actually, the wage levels are greater in Japan and just a little bit less than that in South Korea than the United States.
Mike, I'm going to guess that in 1920, shipbuilding in America was far more robust than it is now. Is that accurate?
Actually, one of the reasons for the passage of the Merchant Marine Act of 1920 was to reinvigorate U.S. shipbuilding.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. U.S. shipbuilding had been subsidized by the U.S. government during World War II for the production of merchant ships.
Right.
The so-called war-built ships.
Right.
And we would repeat that, of course, in World War II. But after that, there was a decline in shipbuilding. And it was thought that by restricting those ships built – that restricting the coastal trade to those ships that were built in the U.S. would provide a market. But unfortunately, the market has declined since then. And
well,
it never really worked. American shipbuilding has not been competitive since the Civil War. We were highly competitive in the days of wooden ships and sail power. But once the transition was being made to iron ships and steam power, the U.S. lost competitive edge.
Well, what you're describing is a law that has long since outlived its usefulness and now is being blamed for hindering relief efforts to a place in desperate need.
We don't have, in the U.S. Jones Act fleet, we don't have the numbers and the kinds of different ships that will be needed for the recovery in Puerto Rico.
But the international, if we were to just open this up, as has now been done, this waiver now opens up to any ship that
yes,
can deliver.
Yes, that's correct. But the problem with it, it's only 10 days.
Yeah, right.
And for a foreign vessel owner to reposition his ship and to get the kind of operation going where he could be moving different kinds of cargo from the U.S. mainland into Puerto Rico is going to take longer than that.
So now you're making it sound like a somewhat empty symbolic gesture.
At this present time, that's essentially what it is. I think that President Trump did this under extreme pressure from a number of different groups.
Well, it's been a week at least since Hurricane Maria.
And people are Democrats who are critical of the president, of course, are saying that Maria will be his Katrina, referring to the blame that George W. Bush got for that response in Katrina. So I think there's enormous political pressure on him to act.
Well, given what you're saying, that the 10 days might not make that much of a difference, it would seem that the gesture of the 10-day waiver could backfire.
Right. The sort of lead on the Democratic Party side is Representative Velasquez of New York. She's originally from Puerto Rico and one of the so-called five Puerto Rican congresspersons, people who are of Puerto Rican descent.
But there are no voting representatives from Puerto Rico.
Right.
Yeah.
But these five, they represent mainland districts,
right,
mostly with heavy Puerto Rican constituencies.
Mm-hmm.
And they are called the Puerto Rican congresswomen, and I guess now congresswomen as well.
Yeah.
There is one. Puerto Rico is an unincorporated territory of the United States, and they have a single non-voting delegate that serves a four-year term, which is unique in the Congress.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. And they can vote in committee and in the so-called Committee of the Whole, but they can't vote on the floor of the Congress.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I would imagine that would be a bit of a helpless feeling, given what we're hearing day to day coming out of Puerto Rico.
Right, and the current representative from Puerto Rico is a Republican, so she should have some ability to move the majority there.
Well, Mike, what has been the effect? Because we've heard many discussions of the Jones Act over the years in terms of its impact on Hawaii. What is its impact on Hawaii, and what would Hawaii benefit from a repeal?
We don't advocate for a full repeal of the Jones Act.
Mm-hmm.
What we're proposing is to reform the Jones Act, in particular, for the non-contiguous jurisdictions to exempt them from the U.S. build requirement. That would allow the use of foreign-built U.S. flag.
Still U.S. flag, though.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. And in these trades.
Mm-hmm.
And that would considerably lower the capital cost. It would lower what the economists refer to as barriers to entry, because mm-hmm. this is the problem that we're seeing now in that scuffle between Tote Maritime and Pasha Hawaii over who gets the terminal in Honolulu Harbor and who can afford to build the ships that are necessary.
Mm-hmm.
The cost of building is so high that it becomes an enormously difficult task to put together a service. And it shouldn't be that difficult. I mean, it's not that difficult in the rest of the world, and it shouldn't be that difficult here in the United States. And it's all driven by the very high cost of the ships.
So we're protecting, sounds as if we might be protecting an industry that is no longer viable.
It's no longer competitive, that's for sure.
Yeah. So you'd like to see it reformed but not repealed.
Yeah, and there's a problem with, you could do away with the flag requirement, but the problem there is that there's a whole series of other state and federal laws that impinge upon the operation of a vessel,
mm-hmm.
immigration, customs, et cetera, et cetera.
pretty complicated thicket of information. Mike, I really appreciate your being able to help us sort it out. Thank you. Mike Hansen is president of the Hawaii Shippers Council and a commercial ship broker and consultant. He ran his Honolulu Ship Agency from the late 70s through the 90s. He was also involved in ship chartering, founded a container shipping company that operated a direct liner service from Honolulu to the South Pacific. If you're curious about the value of so-called STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math, consider the life of Colonel Mike Fink, astronaut, has had. Three space flights, including a six-month stay aboard the International Space Station, more than a year of his life spent orbiting the Earth. The retired Air Force colonel is coming to Hawaii to give the keynote address at the third annual Future Focus, the Hawaii Innovation Initiative's Forum on Astronomy, Space Exploration, Cybersecurity, and more at the Hawaii Convention Center. He spoke with us earlier today about the ways the space program has changed our lives.
Well, that's the joy of exploration. You set off on a journey and you don't know everything that's going to happen and all of the lessons that you are going to learn. Fortunately, when we started the space program, we knew it was going to be cool and awesome, but we didn't realize how much it was going to change our lives, all the way from weather satellites to help people and to miniaturization of electronics to understanding fundamental things about our universe. I think we're better and richer for it.
Yes, as you said, a lot of that was unexpected, but the very fact that we had that push toward getting into space, it really kind of jump-started technology.
Indeed, and technology is what keeps our country not just strong, but rich, right? It's our high-tech industry that's leading the rest of the world and keeping our economy moving.
Colonel, what was your journey toward becoming an astronaut? Was it a long-time ambition? Was it something you sort of fell into? How did it work for you?
Well, like many other people, I was inspired by the space program. And in my case, I was very young, watching the first people walk on the moon, and even watching the last people walk on the moon in 1972. And it was one of those things, I think some cultures call it a vocation, right? It's a calling. Mm-hmm. And so I just knew that I just wanted to be an astronaut, and I worked very hard, and I fell down along the way, and I succeeded. In 1996, they selected me, and I've gotten to fly three times in space, and two of them were with the Russians, which I don't want to say as ironic, but it's one of those surprising things of our journey is we had a race against the Russians, and now we work with the Russians.
Yeah, that's one of the things that people don't always understand about the space program. One of the things is that it started, there was a great deal of uneasiness when the Russians launched Sputnik.
Yes, it shocked our country. There was a missile gap, and then there was a education gap, so we began studying science, technology, engineering, and math, helping our children to get smarter so we wouldn't be beat by the Soviets, and then sending things into space. And we stayed behind for a while. In the beginning, the United States was very afraid of the potential of what an enemy, and at that time it was the Soviet Union in the Cold War, could do in space. So we struggled in a race to compete with them. But we soon found that it was better to cooperate in space than to race against each other. And our first cooperation was Apollo Soyuz in 1975, or in Russia they call it Soyuz Apollo. In any case, we learned that it was great to shake hands in space better than to fight or compete against each other. And that set the stage nicely for the International Space Station, which is still flying today. And we work closely with our Russian friends, even though on the ground we might have political disagreements, to say the least. But in space, we work together carefully and for the betterment, and we're doing something constructive and not destructive.
And you experienced that yourself, I mean, as part of your work.
It was quite surreal on my first two flights is that I sat on the same launch pad that Yuri Gagarin did and launched into space, not just on a Russian rocket, but I was a co-pilot.
Uh-huh.
And to fly to the International Space Station for 6 months. And on my very first mission, there was just me and a Russian guy aboard the space station. No visits by the space shuttle. The space shuttle was grounded. And we got along great. In fact, we even did 4 spacewalks together, and that was something very amazing. So there's something, you know, special about going to space where it brings all humans together closer.
When you talk to young people in particular, do you think that passion is still there in the current generation, current young generation?
I think we are in a great spot. I get a chance to talk to a lot of young people. Everybody is very curious. Everybody has this feeling that they can be whoever they want to be if they try hard enough. And there's so many young people that are working really hard, some of them to be, you know, doctors and lawyers, some to be fishermen, some to be just parents, some want to be factory workers, but some want to be astronauts too. And there's a great feeling. And kids these days, they're one with technology. They have their little iPads and tablet devices and smartphones, and they know how to do things. They all want to become dot-com millionaires and invent new things. And that's really exciting for all of us, and it's exciting for the space program. And I'm looking forward to sharing some of my passion with the students in Hawaii in my upcoming trip.
The whole place of Hawaii in the world of astronomy, not just as a location for modern-day astronomy, but historically. Have you been hearing much about that?
Oh, very much so. All the way from the first Polynesian explorers to today's Hokulea expeditions. I mean, that's just fantastic to circumnavigate great parts of our planet without GPS. Like, who can do that? It's amazing. It's a fantastic skill, and it just goes to show how much we are born as explorers. And then you add the astronomy that gets done on the Big Island and in Maui and these other places in Hawaii. Several of my astronaut friends actually, you know, they did some of their astronomy work, you know, at the University of Hawaii. So there's a lot of connection between Hawaii and the rest of the and the whole space program.
You're pretty confident about the future of the space program, the future of education, you know, STEM learning and education, all those kinds of things?
I'm very confident. I know that people realize that that's one of the paths forward in life is to study science, technology, engineering, and math. There's a lot of people that are really pushing towards it, but there's so many things for people that can do this. There's 3D printers are incredibly inexpensive now. You make your own programming classes on the internet for free kind of thing. There's so many opportunities out there that, you know, the younger generations, like my Generation X, we didn't have. We helped invent them. And now that they're there, the kids these days have a lot more opportunity. And with a little encouragement from their teachers or their families, then the sky's the limit.
Technology can drive a great deal of innovation. Each new invention seems to stimulate new ideas, doesn't it?
Quite. And not only that, for the most part, technology has made our lives better. I mean, we can light up the night. Don't have to fear the dark anymore with our electric light bulbs, and now we have solar panels and LED bulbs, and things become a little bit easier and more fancy, and makes our lives a little bit easier.
Well, that's the idea, isn't it, Colonel?
Indeed. We're trying to make things better for all humans, and not just this world, but the other new planets that we're constantly discovering. We should just go out and explore like those early Polynesian explorers and leave our homes behind and find something new.
Colonel Mike Fink, U.S. Air Force retired, will come to Honolulu as keynote speaker to the 3rd annual Future Focus, the Hawaii Innovation Initiatives Forum on Astronomy, Space Exploration, Cybersecurity, and more. The day-and-a-half conference will be held on October 4th and 5th at the Hawaii Convention Center. Access to public records is essential for public access to government and to the work of journalists working to cover government operations. The Office of Information Practices at the state capitol is the gateway to a public record search, and an effort to triple its fees and alter its rules is drawing fire from open government advocates. Joining us with that story for today's Reality Check is political and opinion editor Chad Blair. Hi, Chad. Thanks for talking
Hi,
with
Chris.
Us.
Yeah, sure.
Well, OIP is no doubt a familiar location for you. It's where you go to find out a great many things, and it's very important to journalists and to the public, right?
Well, absolutely. Civil Beat, a lot of our best stories, most important stories, have come from filing public records requests. I mean, yeah. I'll just name three. We've been reporting on them on this program, of course. Police misconduct, right?
Right.
Reforming our prison system, getting information about how we deal with the homeless. Those are just three issues, and we're not the only ones. The Honolulu Star Advertiser, other media, and independent groups, good government groups, try and get this information as well. So it's very important that we have this. It is a state law. It's the UIPA. But now OIP, which is tasked with overseeing the law, wants to change the rules. And some of the suggestions they have, the proposals, well, they're not sitting well with good government groups and with a lot of journalists, including here at Civil Beat.
Hiking fees, among other things, right?
Exactly. They're looking at actually charging you three times as much to photocopy and to redact documents. You know, redact, right? They take a big black marker and cross out the parts that you can't see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a pretty big expense. There's also, generally, there has been a waiver of a fee if it's in the public interest. You know, if a news media group is going to report it to the public,
right.
Well, they're looking at maybe changing some of the waiver fees as well. Well, this is contrary to what states like California and Arizona do, which feel that this is a pretty basic right.
Given the fact that these proposed changes are all too likely to produce the kind of feedback that has us talking about
right.
it now, what's the rationale?
Well, the rationale is that, according to OIP, Cheryl Kukazu Park, she says there's been a lot of requests, and it's bogging a lot of government agencies down. It costs a lot of money as well, although we actually looked at it. If they did increase the fees or kept it where it was, it's really just a fraction of the overall state operational budget. But
mm-hmm.
those are some of the things they've been saying, that, look, somebody's got to actually produce these results, these records for you. That takes time. That takes money. And she said they're trying to strike a balance between the public's right and an agency's ability to deliver on the request.
You would think that the public's right to know would have quite a bit of weight on that particular seesaw, wouldn't you?
Let's hope so. We have until Saturday to comment on this. It's online on OIP's website. And then there will be another public comment period later. Governor Ige will ultimately weigh in on the final rules.
It'd be interesting to see what shakes out. Thanks very much, Chad.
Thanks, Chris.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring political and opinion editor Chad Blair. Theater forms around the world have embraced puppetry for centuries, but in the West it has come to be regarded as a children's entertainment. That's how it seemed to Tom Lee when he began his journey to becoming a master puppeteer, but he's learned a great deal since then. His fascination with the Kuruma Ningyo style and his collaboration with Japanese master puppeteer Koryu Nishikawa have led to the creation of Tom's new show, Shank's Mare, now touring the islands. Tom talked with us about how his avocation took on a whole new meaning for him.
Often in the U.S. and in the West, people kind of associate puppetry with something that is for kids. It's something juvenile and maybe not serious.
Mm-hmm.
But as I've done my research, my studies, you really see that puppetry is actually a very profound and deep form, capable of a huge range of emotional power. From almost anything you can imagine.
And what led you on that journey? Because I suspect when you were a kid, you started off with children's puppets, the familiar ones that we know about. And what led you toward Japan?
Well, it actually was Hawaii that led me to kind of discover puppetry as the thing that I now practice as my art form. I was a 16-year-old kid in Mililani, and I went to a summer program on the Big Island, mm-hmm. and we did a Bunraku-style puppet show of Momotaro, the Peach Boy, and uh-huh. I played the left hand.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, and I, you know, it was an amazing experience. I had no idea what it meant or that somebody could do that for a living. And my focus was much more on being an actor. But later, when I went to New York and I was working as an actor, performing, I was also doing work on the side as a stage carpenter and technician. And it was at that time that I began to work at La Mama Experimental Theater mm-hmm. in New York. And I began to see puppet artists working with puppetry in ways that I'd never seen before. It just blew my mind, the emotional content of what they were doing, both like really, really bawdy and profane, and also super emotional and deep. And one of these puppet artists said, "Hey, Tom, you're pretty good at this. Have you ever thought about making your own work?" And that's when it clicked for me, Chris. That's when I was like, wow, maybe there's a combination between my desire to perform and my desire to design and build things. Yeah, that's kind of where I got really serious about beginning to study Japanese puppetry and other forms of puppetry.
So you make your own puppets and create a character from that?
That's correct. I do many things in theater, and one of them is creating my own pieces. Shank's Mare that we're doing here on Oahu is one example.
Mm-hmm.
I also design puppets specifically for other people and direct the puppet movement. And I also perform as a puppeteer. I've done War Horse on Broadway, and this fall, after I return from Hawaii, I'll be performing at the Metropolitan Opera, doing the young boy in Madama Butterfly as a Bunraku-style puppet.
Because more and more artists and art forms are integrating puppetry in ways. I'm thinking of, Julie Taymor's work, for example, going back maybe 20, 30 years, but began to introduce objects like puppets into theater that hadn't seen that before.
Absolutely. You know, it's an incredibly evocative form, and people like go, wow, puppets. Wow, that's so cutting edge. That's so new. But you think about it, puppetry has been around for millennia, you know?
Quite a while,
Almost every culture around the world has some form of puppet or mask theater. Mm-hmm. And the use of objects, the use of figures is so essential to our kind of belief in animating kind of inanimate objects as humans, I think. And so that's why I think it's a really effective and interesting form.
Because you project onto a figure, don't you, in theater. The idea is to give an inanimate object life.
Exactly. And, you know, you can think of a puppet in a way as a mirror. You know, it is fixed. It doesn't move. It doesn't have facial expressions, although sometimes there are, you know, eyes that can move and whatnot.
Yeah.
But it's really the way the puppet moves that the viewer perceives as being filled with a particular emotion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you see the figure bow its head and bring its hands to its eyes and tremble gently, you think, oh, he's crying or he's sad. The puppet's not crying, he's just a piece of wood. But you, the viewer, is inferring and projecting that emotion upon it. And that's why, Chris, it's so interesting, because the audience invests in an emotional way in a different way than you have with a live actor.
It's safe, in a way.
In a way, yeah. And in a way, the fourth wall that separates, you know, you want to believe that an actor is there in a situation,
mm-hmm.
Kind of operates in a different way, since you project what you think the puppet is thinking on it. And that's why it can be incredibly, incredibly effective and also really hard to pull off well.
Well, I would think for you as an actor, it makes you think of the importance of gesture, how the slightest nuance of a movement convey a powerful emotion if it's done right.
Absolutely.
The turn of a head, one eye half closed, anything like that, a tiny gesture, right?
Absolutely. And that's what you see in, I think, really amazing puppeteers. They're able to be full of life and also extremely precise in the way they tell stories through movement. And Koryu Nishikawa, the artist that we're working with, to see him perform is like a master class in just what you're talking about.
the form of puppetry that you've chosen, could you describe it for me a little bit?
Yes. I was fortunate enough to find out about this form, which is called Kuruma Ningyo, or cart puppetry, about 12 years ago when I first went to Japan to study traditional theater and puppetry on a NEA grant. And Kuruma Ningyo as a form is a relative of the Bunraku or San Ninzukai three-person manipulation puppetry form that most people are familiar with. But Kuruma Ningyo is basically a one-person puppetry form. The puppets are about the same size as those in Bunraku, but instead of them being operated by three operators, they're operated by a single puppeteer. And the puppeteer sits on a small rolling cart called a kuruma. He puts the puppet's feet between his toes, so as he walks, the puppet's feet move.
Uh-huh.
And then in this remarkable series of mechanisms and manipulation, he holds the head, left hand, and right hand with both of his hands, and then is able to control all five points of this moving figure just by rolling about the stage and manipulating it.
Making you a performer as much as the puppet, it sounds like.
Absolutely. And also making a very direct one-to-one relationship between performer and puppet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Bunraku style, three people have to assume the identity of a single character. But in Kuruma Ningyo and other one-person forms like that, the performer has much more kind of freedom, agency to be able to perform the character kind of as a soloist. And that's, I think, one of the really, really powerful things about the form.
It really sounds as if you found something that's going to, into which you can grow for the rest of your life.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty incredible. And I would say that, you know, this puppetry form is also one of the many, many things that I do within the world of puppetry. Koryu Nishikawa, who's the fifth generation master of Kuruma Ningyo, really opened my eyes to all there is out there in terms of Japanese puppetry, which I thought was only one thing when I first came to Japan. But also in Shank's Mare, you'll also see the use of other contemporary puppetry techniques. In fact, the scenography for the whole show is a elaborate miniature model, which is laid out in front of the stage and is tracked with a live feed video camera. And that video, which is all done live, kind of puppeteered live, forms the scenery behind which the play takes place. So the goal with the show is not only to showcase the traditional form, but also to talk about and explore where the form goes from here and how we can arrive in the contemporary moment and still honor these traditions, which are so influential.
Puppeteer and theater artist Tom Lee was on Molokai and Lanai this past week. The Shank's Mare tour continues at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center tomorrow night at 7:30, Sunday afternoon at 2. Tom will be performing at the Pearl City Cultural Center, then on October 4th at the UH Hilo Performing Arts Center, on October 6th at the Kahilu Theater. Get the details at the Conversation Facebook page. And now it's time to return you to the pledge table because we've got some business to do.